Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. A certain section of Glenwood Springs is feeling the effects of the Grand Avenue Bridge construction a lot sooner than expected.
I am seeing virtue in the idea of making Midland Avenue a better street to help take pressure off Grand Avenue in the long term.
In Aspen, school officials are considering naming buildings, classrooms, and programs after donors to raise money in the face of budget cuts.
It just seems like whatever local efforts are done, there's something to counter it on the state level.
And two of the five school board members will have been appointed rather than elected once Bob Glay leaves his post. The Pitkin County Sheriff's Office beefed up its presence at the Aspen Airport in response to the terrorist attacks in Brussels.
What point of view are we going to take? It seems to be mutually exclusive. Either terrorism from the skies is an existential threat to America.
With the memorial of legendary ski racer Bill Johnson being planned for next month, the World Cup finals in 2017, and the NORAM races held earlier in March, Aspen still feels like a ski town.
I think something like that brings a little bit of X Games excitement to Alpine ski racing.
Bargain shoppers found some good deals when Clark's Market in Aspen slashed prices for everything in the store before it closed for a three-month remodel. Joining me this week are Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, Roger Morrill, columnist for the Aspen Times, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Wendell Whiting, columnist for the Aspen Daily News. Well, thank you for coming to the studio and Randy being on the phone down in Glenwood.
Nice to be here.
Glad to participate.
And I'm happy to be here, too.
And me, too.
Randy, can we get a little bridge update, our weekly bridge update in Glenwood?
Well, a surprisingly large impact has already hit us. I was at a meeting Monday at City Hall. It was sort of precipitated by the president of Sopris Elementary School, which is on the south side of Glenwood Springs, talking about some real traffic issues that have come up on that side of town. And what's happened is that as they have done utility work at exit 116, which is the main Glenwood Springs exit, so if people are coming from Rifle or Newcastle to jobs or for other reasons up Valley, that's the exit that they take to get on Highway 82, and that exit eastbound has been closed for utility work on and off lately. So people, you know, you don't necessarily memorize, oh, it's going to be closed from 10 to 4 today and from midnight to 4 a.m. Tuesday. You just think it might be closed. So people are getting off in West Glenwood, and there's no formal detour when the bridge itself is closed at the end of 2017. It's going to route people back through downtown. But that's not marked now, and it's not fully ready. There's going to be a new connection to 8th Street in downtown Glenwood Springs. So people are just staying on Midland Avenue and going to the south side of town, and there's a roundabout out at 23rd Street and Grand Avenue, which is where people who live up 4 Mile Road come into town that way. The school buses go to the elementary school that way, and particularly when it got slick one day last week, there were some just awful traffic jams.
Did they not expect that to happen?
I think that they weren't prepared for it this soon, and Terry Parsh, who is the city engineer, talked about the fact that it is as if the detour is de facto in effect because people are thinking, well, that exit might be closed, so I have to go here. And the city's going to make some traffic changes. But what it was just a little preview of what it's going to be like. I mean, that's some of the traffic, not all of it, that's going to be rerouted. And I think it was a bit of an alarming wake-up call for people. The bridge is still going to be closed in November and December of 2017, so if there's a snowstorm, I mean, there was a 90-minute delay when that happened last Wednesday when it was, you know, we had some snow squalls and it was pretty slick in places.
Yeah, you'd be better off to drive to No Name and turn around and then come back and get off on the regular.
And yeah, I think people want to avoid that because a couple of folks inadvertently did it, and that's just topping off at 114. But there was some discussion between city officials and CDOT officials and the local police about, you know, we should start our publicity campaign now. And then others are saying, no, it's too early for that. So it's an interesting discussion. A whole new bypass might be too expensive and impractical, but I am seeing virtue in the idea of making Midland Avenue a better street to help take pressure off Grand Avenue in the long term. I think over the next 2 years, we're going to have a lot of headaches. If you aren't stuck in traffic at some point in Glenwood Springs during that period of time, I think you're just lucky. And it also has the potential for some long-term insight maybe into what's needed here.
It seems to me that it might ease congestion a little bit if people are getting off on, is it 116 is the one in West Glenwood?
114.
Oh, 114, that's
okay. 116 is the main one, yeah.
So from there you have two choices to get through Glenwood. You can go, I don't know the names of the roads, Randy, but you can go that back way by Target, or you can go the other way that passes Village Inn. So it seems like the traffic would be split into two different groups going through downtown Glenwood, which might make it faster.
Yeah, right now, Midland on the south end, where you kind of head back toward Highway 82, is not really equipped for the extra traffic. And I think that was the takeaway from what happened mm-hmm. last week. There was talk of the school changing its start time so that there's not as much congestion.
I'm just so surprised that they would consider asking the school to change their start times. I think there would be other ways to accommodate because, the impacts there from parents to teachers to school bus drivers to end of the day to childcare, that's huge.
Yeah, it seems like work would be more flexible for most people.
I would imagine. Randy, I thought it was interesting that the city, is it? They don't want to really think about a year ahead from now. Are they afraid that tourism is going to be hurt if they start, you know, really blowing this out and talk about how bad it really could be?
That might be part of it. And actually, it was the city engineer who was advocating that a little bit, and it was the police chief and CDOT folks who were saying, no, no, it's too early because people will become numb to it, and then they won't actually do it if we cry wolf now when we need them to do it. It's a really interesting debate, and I think it is going to force some decisions and some spending about how to get through Glenwood long-term and short-term.
Budget overruns already?
What a surprise.
Another issue that's going to get, I think, a full debate is, in the Aspen community, is Madeline and I tied on a story on Thursday morning about naming rights from donors for the Aspen School District. And this has been a contentious issue for a long time, and it's usually been batted away pretty quickly. But given the state funding that continues to go away, it's something that I think the school board is considering a little bit more than they have in the past.
Well, I think they have to consider it because they're broke. And the Tabor continues to take money away, and there's the negative effect. And it just seems like whatever local efforts are done, there's something to counter it on the state level. However, I do think that this is going to require a huge community discussion about our values and whether this is correct for the Aspen community. I mean, I remember there was, I won't say the name, but there have been a couple proposals, and there's one that went through the David Koch seminar room at the Aspen Institute. It has become kind of polarizing. I think about Enron Field in Houston or where in Texas where that is, and they've had to change the name, and I thought it was very interesting.
Sports Authority.
Yeah. Sports Authority. And Wellington Webb, former mayor of Denver, had an excellent piece in the Denver Post last month, or actually it was just about 2 weeks ago, talking about if he had to do it over, he would never name a public facility or allow naming rights.
Well, remember the Pepke Auditorium? They were going to rename that. What was the family that made a big donation, and they were going to change the auditorium's name? Is that the name you weren't going to say?
That is the name. That is the
I'm
name.
Sorry about that.
But I mean the fact that there's right next to Pepke Auditorium, there is a room named after one of the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
What about Lewis Ice Arena?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? That's interesting because they basically paid for the whole thing.
Yeah.
If you pay for the whole building, I don't have a problem with that, but
there's tax dollars there.
Well, not on the ice arena. That was funded 100% by.
But it's maintained by tax dollars.
Well, no, that's true.
That's true. It's subsidized by the city.
But you know, if somebody steps in and say gives a $10 million donation, that's a huge donation. But compared to the cost of the high school, I don't think it would be appropriate to name, you know, the building after whoever gave the $10 million. So.
How about the lunchroom or a seminar room?
That's kind of weird. I mean, I don't know. I think the public really needs to weigh in on it.
So your wife, Susan, has been part of this decision making, right?
Yes, I'm on the Aspen Education Foundation board. Susan's on the school board.
Okay,
the Board of Education.
Board of Education.
Okay, that's the difference.
So just to tee it up for the listeners, the Aspen Education Foundation is a not-for-profit fundraising arm for the school district. And the foundation is bringing forward this idea to the school board, which is going to consider it and maybe change policy. And then it would be decided on a case-by-case basis, depending on who you all go out and get as far as donors go. Yeah. So what's been the conversation from a foundation's perspective?
Well, I don't speak for the foundation. I disagree with them a little bit. I mean, I see some big issues with it, and namely just division of the community, where the taxpayers are footing the bill for most of the school. I mean, you talk about a $10 or $15 million endowment fund that kicks off about $750,000 a year at 5% earning. And that amounts to less than 4% of the school's annual operating budget. So $15 million sounds like a big pile of money, but you have to keep that in perspective. The voters are footing the bill for the other 95% of the operating expenses of the school district. So is it fair to put one person's name on a building or a room or a program when still the taxpayers are funding the vast majority of our schools?
My takeaway on it is it's interesting that we live in a community that it's basically there's no question that we could get the money if we offered the naming rights to any portion of the school campus. Because we have the people that would be able to do that, which is an interesting thing that we're kind of beyond the debate. The discussion isn't, do you think we could find people? It's more, should we let them? Mm-hmm. In most communities, I don't think we have that, or they would have that option, just to assume that there's going to have that money. And the other thing, though, is with the Tabor Amendment, I feel like if we start giving in and filling in the gaps that the Tabor Amendment is creating, then it just justifies or makes the Tabor Amendment something that's going to stick around, like, because whoever thinks it's a good idea is, look, people are footing the bill, so the government doesn't need to be paying
right.
for it.
It just makes it that much stronger.
Well, that's right, and you bring up another good point, that if the voters locally start to get used to wealthy people stepping up to, fund our schools, then maybe we're a lot more reluctant to pass new bond initiatives and tax increases and things like that. So we may leave ourselves a little bit exposed in the long run if we go short term for big money from individuals.
Randy, could you ever see the RE1 district?
It strikes me as sort of a dangerous precedent for some of the reasons that are cited. And while I suppose there may be some people who would be able and willing to do that in this district, it just seems pretty far-fetched.
There was something else interesting that happened at the school board meeting. Actually, it was a very, very interesting four-hour meeting.
You went, not me.
Glad I could fill in for you, Carolyn. Bob Glay announced his resignation at the end of April, and that means we will have, out of 5 board members, 2 will be appointed by their colleagues. And I think there's an inherent danger when you have almost half the board who have been chosen rather than elected by the people.
Well, yeah, it's... What do you do about that, though? I mean, you could have another election, but that's not really the way it's set up. So it's, but I think Bob only has another year left.
A year and a half.
So you'd have someone appointed for a year and a half, and then it would be turned back over to the voters to.
And again, when the discussion came up in the meeting the other day, it sounded just the casual discussion like people wanted to find some who had similar views to their own. And I'm not sure that's a great idea either.
Well, and just to backtrack a little bit, the person they appointed in the fall was the third place vote getter in the election. So,
you know, Valley Roundup is a news analysis show, but every once in a while, especially when I have 2 columnists in the room, and an outspoken contributing editor, that sometimes there's opinion which aren't always the view of Aspen Public Radio. However, I think it's important to provide some context and different sides of the argument. So appreciate that.
Okay.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with writers and editors in the Valley. Joining me are Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, Roger Merle, columnist for the Aspen Times, Madeline Osberger, contributing editor for the Aspen Daily News, and Wendell Whiting, columnist for the Aspen Daily News. Also in the headlines this week was terrorist attacks in Brussels, which here, our local law enforcement responded by beefing up its presence at the airport. It was a request by the airport director to the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office to provide a deputy there the entire time the airport's open, from like 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., whereas before it was just a deputy who was on shift who would just go by the airport as part of his or her patrol. So I found it interesting because whenever there's an attack, you'll watch the national news and you'll see increased security all over the country at Times Square and at the, you know, LaGuardia and all these places. And I wonder, what is the purpose of that? Is it to make us feel better about our safety, or is it to show the world that we're doing something? Shouldn't we have that beefed up security all the time?
Or not?
Now, when I lived in Detroit, I knew a guy who worked at the Canadian consulate in Windsor, worked on U.S.-Canadian economic issues, and he called what we do security theater. We're taking our shoes off because some third-string guy had explosives in his shoes, and, you know, fortunately they're not making us take our underwear off because of the underwear bomber. I feel like the TSA ought to have that down, and that the idea of having local law enforcement, I mean, Times Square is one issue, but having local law enforcement at a facility that's overseen by the TSA really does seem like a waste of local resources to me.
Well, you look at it logically. I think a lot of our security measures are just window dressing. If you look at the numbers of the minutes and hours and days combined that we waste in airport security, how many lives does that add up to over the course of a year or 10 years? Would we lose that many lives to terrorists, acts of terror, if we didn't do that? So I think a lot of it is just for show. I really do, especially locally. You don't ever want to say it couldn't happen here, but I don't think it's a big fear of anyone.
It makes no sense to me, because what exactly would a sheriff's deputy do if there was something that was the same as Belgium? On top of that, it's kind of, what point of view are we going to take? It seems to be mutually exclusive. Either terrorism from the skies is existential threat to America, in which case we should be taking it seriously. We should be hiring very smart people to be in the TSA. We shouldn't be having very low standards for who we hire, and we should be paying them a lot more if we actually believe it's a threat. But clearly we don't, because we allow people with GEDs, very little education, no training, and we pay them nothing. And they take away, you know, peanut butter, but they'll allow any amount of liquid if it's labeled breast milk. And it's none of it makes any sense to me. And right after, years later, they went back and did a study of after 9/11, when everyone was afraid of flying, what happened to deaths in vehicles. And they were able to directly attribute in the 2 years following 9/11 that just as many people died in car accidents because they were afraid of flying as died in the World Trade Center attacks. So in the end, it's like, it's a lot of wasted money for no reason. And when you have ramp agents that don't have to go through security, can directly walk on planes, and there was that thing on the East Coast where there was a huge smuggling ring of guns, and they're just, you can randomly put guns on planes because you work on the ramp and there's no security check. The whole thing is security theater. It makes no sense.
You travel a lot now for your job, and you've also worked at the airport.
Yes.
So this is where your perspective comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was talking to the airport director, he pointed out, like, look, this is one approach of a multi-layered approach, which I don't know what that is. But one could argue that we have a lot of really important people that fly in and out, probably more on the ABO side and the private jet terminal. These planes go to pretty big markets. And I would think, I would argue that this is a pretty lax airport. You can get a lot of things through.
Well, you might say that about the whole town. I mean, think about the Forceman Little convention here and the events they have at the Wheeler Opera House. If somebody's really out to get some important people in the world, they could do it fairly quickly.
So is it one deputy with a gun that is going that fixes that?
Well, I would argue that for the X Games this year, we had people in plain clothes who could have taken out a shooter. So I think that we aren't as small town minded anymore, Roger. I think that there are efforts. It saddens me greatly that the real world has infringed on our cozy lifestyle here. But
well, I wrote a column about this actually, that during the whole "are we safer because there's a lot of Asians around us?" Makes no sense, because during Food and Wine they have some special division here and big van with lots of fancy equipment, and they're going around searching for radiation and dirty bombs and stuff like that. But it was printed in the paper. If they walk up to you and they get a high radiation reading, you can just say, oh, they ask you, have you had a surgery recently? And if you just say yes, they give you a button that says, you're okay. There's a lot more things in this town that are like the Ideas Festival. I think if something were to happen at that, the world's economy would probably be devastated.
During Christmas week, when the 1% is here and some of the world dignitaries, it's a good point. For sure.
We could lend you Garfield County's Bearcat, and you can just park it outside.
Awesome. Randy, your law enforcement agencies have also contributed to some of the high-profile people that have come here as far as protection goes.
I don't mind spending some public money to protect a former Secretary of State or a former Vice President or a current Vice President. I think that a lot of that law enforcement criticism is somewhat partisan.
Wendell, you talked about your column. In the column on Thursday, you talk about City Market and Clark's Market and just reminding people that Clark's Market is closing on Saturday for 3 months at least. And there'll be, Aspen's a one grocery store town. If you go outside the city limits, there's Roxy's, of course. But Tuesday, they had a huge 50% off sale. Felt like the apocalypse on Tuesday during the lunch hour.
I went twice. I thought it was a lot of fun, actually, and people were just really enjoying it. And the Snowmass Clarks, to me, if it's a lot like that, is amusing, because the Snowmass Clark I consider nightclub shopping.
Why?
Because it's so dark. I think put in a big sound system and some spinning colored lights, I think it would perfectly match the environment and it would be even more fun. So I'm hoping we get that here.
Well, City Market is certainly going to get a lot busier.
It doesn't need to get busier.
No, it's just, it's hard to shop there anyway.
Full contact shopping.
It is.
Exactly.
What did you get, Wendell, on the 50% off day?
Pretty much everything I made fun of other people getting in my column, which is like cheese and coconut water.
Speaking of
Snowmass. The center will be sold on March 31st. Jordan Sarek is buying it from Related as Related continues to shed their assets.
And what do you think that means?
I think that means that as soon as they can find buyers for other things, that they might be on the road.
Related?
Possibly. They've said that they will see the project through. I don't know if that means the people they assign to see it through will take care of it.
Well, we've heard that from everybody involved with that project day one.
But they're back with it in their hands, aren't they, after shedding it once.
I think this is a good move in Snowmass, that they're finally even considering shedding pieces one by one out there, which means it's probably cheaper, and as soon as they get rid of that stuff for what it's really worth, then developers can come in and really go for it and finish the job.
I think Eastwood will do a good job at the center, if, given what they did at Highlands, filling in a little. Like to disclose that the Sarek's are friends of mine, personal friends, and Carolyn's as well.
Nice. They are very nice people.
Yes, yes. And that Jordan, again, when he bought Highlands, I think it was 2006 or 2007, 40% non-occupied spaces there, and now it's 100%. And, you know, he gave a different thought to it. Well, let's have some maybe offices where we'd normally have failing retail.
Do you want to talk about your story you wrote about Bill Johnson?
Bill Johnson.
Since you have the floor.
Yes. I wasn't living in Aspen in 1984. I was in Colorado, and I remember distinctly the Olympics that year, 1984. I mean, Kristen Cooper, silver medal. It was just such a great time, great U.S. ski team. And then we have this cocky guy, Bill Johnson, predicting he's going to win. He had won the Lauberhorn, I believe, just before that. And then the Europeans were like, nose picker, whatever the translation was for that in German. Widely teased and just derided, and Bill just stuck to his guns, won the gold medal, and then said he was going to win in Aspen, and he did. And I think the U.S. ski team considers that one of the greatest moments in American race history. I understand from what people have said, Scott Nichols said it was just the place Aspen came apart here. The whole, the stands were thumping. Roger, you were probably
here. I was. I remember that very well. It was very exciting because he was not only non-traditional in his personality, he was non-traditional in his skiing, where he'd come down the mountain and he'd look like he was completely out of control and wild, but he was fast.
Yeah,
and
it
really was something.
And they honored him last week?
Well, they're going to.
There is a ceremony?
No, they're going to honor him on, it's the last, I think it's the 9th of, it's a Saturday in April, and they're going to retrace, which I think is really cool, a number of friends of his. It's during the U.S. Ski Hall of Fame week. It's not really affiliated with it, but it's the same weekend. He'll be honored. People are going to go up to the top of the old downhill start, top of Ruthie's, that little shack, recreate Bill's run, you know, go over to Aztec, there'll be charges thrown, and then going across the finish line, people will continue their route down there, and then his mother is going to spread some ashes. I hope that's allowed in the public place. I think
sure
it would be enough people spread ashes on Aspen Mountain. They were a little reticent about making that part public. And there's going to be a lot of luminaries and former downhill and U.S. ski team people, and I would imagine some Europeans as well. It's a big deal, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
So Aspen still is a ski town.
Hopefully. Right. Hopefully.
Yes, it is.
I'm working on I'm helping with organizing the 2017 World Cup finals, and there's a lot of energy behind trying to make it a real fun event for the town, but it's so hard these days to get something like it was back then, like people excited for downhill racing.
Right. What do you think will be special for this World Cup finals? Concerts or
chairlift?
I think there's a lot of plans to make it a big deal, but I think the key will be getting the community interested in it. I think the organization behind it and the production of it is going to be top-notch, but really getting the community behind it is going to be key.
Just last week at the races we hosted, the dual-format slalom, I think, was a big hit. And it's just one of those events where you can watch it start to finish, you can see who's beating who, and I think something like that brings a little bit of, it's a curse word to say in the ski racing realm, but a little bit of X Games excitement to alpine ski racing, which I think it sorely needs.
Which casual watchers can just see who wins
yeah.
and not figure out.
You don't have to know about ski
watching
racing.
Watching the clock,
Whoever crosses the finish line first wins and goes to the next round. So that was cool.
When they had the Vail head-to-head race last year during the World Championships, they had it at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so half the town could come out and watch. It would be great if this could be, I don't know, because of the spring conditions, if they can move it late in the day like that.
Bring some lights in, do it at night. That would really be something
that
cool.
That would be unbelievable.
Well, awesome. Thanks for taking the time, Randy down in Glenwood, and Wendell Whiting, columnist for the Aspen Daily News, Roger Merolt, columnist for the Aspen
Always
Times,
good to be here.
And Madeline Osberger, contributing editor at the Aspen Daily News.
Thank you,
Carolyn. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Valley Roundup. Thanks to my guests for joining me this week. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.